Do you have another full, most of the, well, yeah, just until about 24 hours from now, we'll be together still. So there is still the container here with us. So I'd encourage you not to leap out of the container. There's some differences, I think, in the end of retreat when we're all together at a retreat center, and at this point, people are packing and, you know, thinking about traveling and things like that. And there's a big shift in the mind that happens. And so you might be interested in what's the shift of the mind that happens in this form of retreat? Because there is a shift. There's been a structure of a Dharma container that will be falling apart. And so, what happens in the mind? What kind of thoughts come in? Some of the thoughts might be more just connected to the everyday things that maybe you set aside for this retreat. So some of those thoughts might be coming in. And seeing what happens, what is there to be aware of as the mind understands the containers falling apart? And what is there to be aware of on the other side of the container? Sometimes we have ideas about what mindfulness is. We've been kind of poking holes in that all week. But certain ideas we might have about what I can be mindful of or what it means to be mindful. Agendas, beliefs about the kinds of experiences that are supposed to happen when we're mindful. We could say, in a way, that with this form of practice, especially with this form of practice, the instructions don't change as the retreat container falls apart. Are you aware? What's obvious? Notice how you are in relationship to it. Whether that's having a conversation with your partner or sitting on the cushion, the instructions are the same. What does change, very often the types of objects that are prevalent change. So when we're secluded, spending more time in the sitting, formal practice, maybe not engaging so much with news or media, the mind settles into particular patterns of what it's noticing, and often very much noticing our internal experience. At perhaps a more refined level. Now, this kind of continuous mindfulness, the kind of clarity that can come in retreat practice, the way we can see what's going on in our mind and how we're responding to things, that clarity can be there in daily life. But often that's a place where the mind gets caught by the stuff in daily life, and so it loses mindfulness. So sometimes practicing in daily life, it can be useful to just have the question of like, what's the easiest thing to be aware of here? And not have the agenda to be detailed or precise, but just like, what's obvious or easy here is to know I'm in a meeting and I'm talking to people. Aware of that, and aware of the context too. Aware of appropriateness of response and what kinds of conversations are useful. Ajahn Amaro tells a delightful story of a time he was abbot at Abhayagiri. And he was talking, somebody must have asked him about, being a monastic and like practicing with just understanding the conditioned nature of experience. And Ajahn Amaro says, I'm the abbot of the monastery. I have to take care of things at the monastery. We're paving the new road to the monastery. And, when the city commissioner calls me up and is talking to me about that, it's not useful to say it's all empty. It's useful to say, how can I help you today? What's the context that we're working with? So this kind of not clinging to, we've really been diving towards, or kind of the talks really have been pointing to the wisdom teachings of the Buddha, the tottering nature of experience, impermanent, unreliable, not self. And yet we can get attached to that perspective and then lose touch at times with the kind of the sense of what's the context that we're in and what's the connection there. This reminds me of what I mentioned the other day around Philip mentioning to me, when you're talking to somebody, hold the connection, hold the relationship in your mind, as opposed to orienting more towards emptiness, just phenomenon arising and passing. Understand the context, understand the meaning, that word that I brought in this morning. This is a place, I think, that's an important connection for us in daily life. If we can't be aware with the everyday meanings of things, and everyday meanings of things, this is a place where we tend to react. So much of our reactivity springs from this. But not necessarily useful, like with what Ajahn Amaro says, to just say, well, it's all empty, so I shouldn't be reacting, or perhaps gaining some capacity to concentrate the mind to shift to the perspective of emptiness and not connect with the meaning. A kind of a form of spiritual bypassing there. And so this kind of blend of understanding emptiness, understanding unreliability, impermanence, and understanding the effect, the impact, the meaning of that in our lives. Understand the meaning of how that, you know, those truths are what we're all trying to navigate in our different ways, with different views and perspectives to attempt to navigate them. And at a kind of a very human level, the meaning is when we're not aligned with those truths, we all suffer. So the recognition of the views, the ideas, the beliefs that people are holding that are shaping how they're responding, the views I'm holding that are shaping how I'm responding, and the context that it's all happening in. At one point on a retreat, I had a very poignant demonstration of this and how the mind can kind of flip into emptiness and lose touch with meaning. And yet, understanding that there was a kind of a balance of mind that happened with that. So it was right after the September 11th attacks. I was at the 3-month retreat at IMS. I arrived a little late. I was a couple weeks late. And I had seen many, many images on television about the suffering that was happening there. And the images were very present in my meditation. It's a lot of what I worked with during the retreat. And a lot of what I worked with was a lot of reactivity and fear and anger and confusion. And, you know, so seeing the images and feeling the fear and feeling the reactivity to that event. This shouldn't have happened. Bad people did bad things. My mind in that kind of thrashing around. So that was a lot of my retreat, and there would be times when the mind got very quiet and still and just kind of in the space of seeing phenomenon. And in one of those times, one of the images from the television around the September 11th attacks arose in the mind, and it was just like seeing blue. There was a seeing of the image. It was just like the image was a slide that flashed in my mind, and it was no more impactful in the mind than seeing the color blue. And the next moment, the mind was disturbed by that. It felt, that feels weird. Not to have any reaction to that, not to have, I mean, I think I was thinking not to have a reaction of anger or fear or frustration. But a few moments later, the image arose and the mind connected with the meaning of the image, what it meant. The first time it didn't, it was just like blue. It was like, and the second time, the mind understood the suffering that represented, that somebody, the image was, you know, of a particular experience and somebody, you know, losing their lives and, you know, kind of the image of that and the suffering that person must have felt, the fear, the anxiety, the ripple effects that would have out into their family. The mind comprehended the meaning, but the mind was still so balanced that it just opened, the heart just opened and just felt the compassion. And it didn't resist that this was the truth, that this person had lost their lives. This person had died. It didn't resist that. It didn't get angry about that. So there was this meeting of the meaning with that mind of understanding conditioned nature of experience, impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And there was this open heart that received that. This kind of connecting, I mean, I think often when we do connect with meaning in our daily, when we read the news or, you know, there's a lot of reactivity that comes up. And so we might, you know, just want to turn aside from that. Just turn aside and or get into the reactivity, you know. So what we need to do in this middle path, in this middle way, is to open to the reactivity and explore understanding the truths and the deep wishes for happiness and well-being. These two together. Kind of confusion that our mind tangles them up. So not to be afraid of the meaning, not to be afraid of the content. And the curiosity. So I think I mentioned this morning. The curiosity around, how does this content affect the mind? Titrating it if you need to, taking little bits of it if you need to, knowing when it's useful to set it aside and bring the mind to balance. But in terms of working with daily life, we need to understand how to work with content, how to work with context. If we think context and content are not a part of our practice, I think I said this yesterday, you know, vast portions of our lives are off limits for mindfulness. That question of what's obvious now, maybe touch into this. Like, what's obvious now is I'm frustrated in this interaction with this person. Okay, that's what's happening. And, you know, holding the context, not just trying to, I mean, we in daily life, we kind of have to do the best we can. It's not that we can, like, say in that moment often, hold on a second, I need to right now turn inward and feel this frustration. We need to do the best we can and meet the experience with whatever mindfulness is available. And I sometimes say, get really good at cleaning up the mess. If you have acted unskillfully in that. Another tool that's useful in daily life to support working with meaning, with content, with context, in a way that is not quite so fast moving. I mean, often in our daily lives, things are happening so fast, our mindfulness may not quite have the momentum to keep up with it. Not to say it's not possible. It's amazing what can happen, even in little moments, for a few moments, really seeing the context, the content, all of it in a few moments and a clear understanding of a skillful response arising. That can happen in daily life. But often we are caught up in our thoughts, in our reactions, and we may not act so skillfully. And so a useful tool can be at a time when you have some space to use our capacity for reflection, the capacity when in the evening, when if you've had something really challenging happen or some particular content that feels like it's triggering something that's happening in your life that it's like, wow, when I'm in the midst of that, there's nothing but anxiety. It can be useful to, allow yourself to take some time, settle the mind, sit down, let the mind just come into some balance. And then use the capacity to reflect, use the capacity of the mind to engage with thoughts. Bring that thought into the mind, that situation, that event, what was happening. Just let yourself remember it and then feel what's happening. So those thoughts are content then that affects the experience. And so this is a way you can consciously bring content in the mind and have some space, a little bit more meditative space to navigate understanding how that content affects you. So this is called reflective practice. Coincidentally, Ajahn Amaro is the one I learned this practice from, too. It's a beautiful practice. He described it like, and I've used this image and this language since then. He described it like just letting your mind settle a little bit, at least get a little bit of quiet, like there's a still pool. And then you drop a thought in like a pebble into that pool and then see what the ripples are. What's the impact of those thoughts on the mind? So you're practicing with content there. How does that content affect you? Often we do get to see the reactivity, but sometimes we might also get to see some of the underlying fears or concerns or compassion, understanding of vulnerability, how vulnerability met with confusion leads to fear. Exploring the entirety of life with mindfulness, no part left out. A quote from a poet. Many of you know this. I think it's something like this. Watching the sky, watching the moon at midnight, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Knowing ourselves completely, understanding the tottering, understanding the impermanent nature, the views that want to solidify, and understanding the context in which it's all happening, the humanness of it, the poignancy of it. The Buddha, this is another inspiration, thinking of the mind of the Buddha. We've been talking about that mind of just no standing, one is stable. Not taking a stand on anything, one is stable. And so that mind of the Buddha evoking perhaps some sense of what that mind might be like, but then remembering the Buddha walked around India for like 45 years and talked to people and went home and had, you know, conversations with his parents about his wife and his son and, you know, dealt with everyday things and acknowledged, in a way, making mistakes. You know, he ordained his son. His wife was a little bit frustrated about the way the Buddha had left them all when his son was so young, and came back when his son was 7 years old, and his mother said, you know, go to your father and ask for his inheritance. Ask for your inheritance, you know, in a kind of a little bit of a twist or something. And so the Buddha ordained Rahula. And his wife and his parents were not happy with this. They said, you should have talked to us. Both parents should be consulted here. And so what did he do? He made a rule that a child being ordained needed permission of both parents. Acknowledging the context. And I think, you know, acknowledging, yeah, I messed up. Like, to me, there's a kind of an acknowledgement there of that. So the Buddha engaged. Content sometimes came into his teachings, and it certainly came into the conversations that he had. He had conversations with kings, and, you know, a king, you know, wanting to talk about invading a kingdom, and you know, the Buddha responding with as much wisdom and compassion as he could, inclining the view of it not being skillful to do that. He engaged with Kisa Gotami with a very everyday teaching. Kisa Gotami, having lost her child, so much grief, she just would not acknowledge that her child was dead. And she carried it around with her, begging it to wake up. And everybody could see that she was deranged. And one person said she might go talk to the Buddha. And so she went and talked to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, I can bring your child back to life if you go to find me a mustard seed from a house where no one has experienced death. So engaging with her at a very kind of content level around the ordinary life and death in our lives. And Kisa Gotami could not find a house where no one had died. And she understood something of the universal nature right there in that understanding. Content supported her understanding that a deep truth of impermanence. And so she ordained. So there's ways that we can learn with content. Reflecting on the meaning, reflecting on the effect that the everyday has on us. A few more things on my list, but that feels like enough talking about practicing as the container falls apart. There are a couple of questions I'll attempt to respond to, and then we'll see if there's any questions in the room. Start with more kind of basic, kind of just a kind of of a content question in a way, but I kind of got interested in this question. And the question was, is there a Pali word for curiosity? We talk about curiosity so much in this practice. It's so central in my own understanding of this practice and interest. Sayadaw often talks about interest and having the mind get interested, spurring the factor of interest in the mind so that it will be, it will investigate. And so, I thought of a few. As far as I know, there's not actually, I looked in some of the indexes of various books and, searched in, for the word interest and curiosity in the suttas. And I found one translation of a sutta that used interest, and that sparked my interest. But I would say in general, there's not a word or words that tend to be translated as interest or curiosity, but there are words that evoke that flavor, that quality. So one of them is right in the Satipatthana Sutta. The definition of what being mindful is says one abides, observing the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having set aside greed and distress for the world. So the word ardent brings in that quality of enlivened connection, heartfelt connection, kind of a interested. I think that we could use interest instead of ardent there. One abides observing the body as a body, interested, fully aware. So that's one word. That Pali word is atapi. Another one, the one that was translated as interest by Nanamoli in a sutta, the Chunky Sutta, Majjhima 95, which talks about finding a teacher and listening to listening to the teacher and gaining faith in the teacher. And gaining faith in the teacher, you give ear to the teacher, and giving ear to the teacher, you understand the teachings and then perhaps gain a reflective acceptance of those teachings. And Nanamoli said, and with that reflective acceptance, a interest springs up. The word that's translating is chanda. Often translated as desire. My understanding in the Pali is that chanda is a neutral quality. And so this desire or interest or can be applied to wholesome as well as unwholesome. And there is the use of chanda in the suttas. It's used in both ways. The word for the hindrance of sense desire is kamachanda. So right there, it's used as an unwholesome quality of mind, the attachment to sense pleasure. But chanda is often used in wholesome ways, and it's often translated as zeal. That's how Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it in the Chanki Sutta. Zeal springs up, having gained reflective acceptance. Zeal springs up. Again, another word that's in the terrain of interest. Then there's piti, the quality of joy, often translated as joy or rapture. My understanding, and this has come, I think, mostly through my Western teachers, I think possibly through translations from their Burmese teachers. I don't remember Upandita using this language, but it could have come from that route where the quality of piti is sometimes expressed as rapt interest. And in my experience, it can have that quality. It doesn't as much feel like like what I call joy, but it's like just this intense like curiosity and connection and interest in what's happening. So that's another word that has this flavor. And the last one that I found, or seems connected, and there may be others, I don't know, there might be some other ones. The last one is Dhammavicaya, which is usually translated as investigation. And this is the quality that kind of follows interest. So in one place zeal is used is in the list called the spiritual powers. And there are four spiritual powers: chanda, virya, chitta, and dhammavicaya. So chanda, zeal, interest; virya, energy; chitta, mind; and dhammavicaya, investigation. So the quality of interest and energy springing up with in this case the chitta is understood to be a purity of mind, a mind that is interested in freedom. So the chanda, the zeal, and the energy directed with that interest or that direction of freedom, investigation springs up, the quality of wanting to understand the wholesome and the unwholesome. Dhammavicaya, understood as kind of understanding, discerning, investigation of states as whether they are wholesome or unwholesome. And so investigation has a little bit of a connection with interest. It's not so easy. I think it's interesting with the basis of power, you know, chanda precedes energy. So the interest or the zeal precedes energy. And that to me is a very natural way for energy to come up. We might just try to brute force investigate, you know, just apply energy to investigate, but there's a little bit of more heaviness there. And when there is that interest, it's much more natural for that investigation to unfold. I could go off on a riff on investigation here, but I won't do that right now. another question that's been sitting for a few days. A question about observing mind states and seeing whenever this person notices a mind state, particularly a challenging one. The question asks in particular about a challenging mental formation like anxiety. When mindfulness arises with that, it just vanishes. It drops away. The thoughts and the emotions vanish. So I'm not able to really investigate it or observe it. The question says, I tried looking at the thought when mindfulness arose, but I couldn't stay with the thought unless I actively thought it. So put it into words. That's kind of using reflection in a way, kind of what I was talking about earlier. Bringing the thought into mind and then seeing what's the effect. So that's kind of, there's a little connection to what I just shared about that reflection in terms of this question. Usually what I say with this kind of experience is just notice that happened. If you know, when you are, you become aware within something like anxiety, just note, and it vanishes, just notice that happened. You don't have to try to get the anxiety back in order to look at it. Just notice that, bring the mindfulness arising with experience, that experience vanished. this can happen because of wisdom, this vanishing of a mind state can happen if mindfulness arises, if a clear mindfulness arises with it. Wisdom can just have it release immediately. So that's one reason that could happen. But there are some other reasons that, you know, have maybe to do with the way the mind is attending to experience. There could be, for instance, in the arising of the, and this isn't necessarily a problem, but in the arising of the mindfulness, the mind is actually more interested in the mindfulness than it is in that thing. And so it goes away. It's not really the wisdom of seeing through it that makes it go away, but it's kind of more like the mind is like, oh, mindfulness is here. And it's more interested in that side of it. And so the attention has come out of the thing that was making you anxious. And so that anxiety goes away. But it's not necessarily wisdom about the anxiety there. It's kind of almost a focus of turning to another object there. Oh, here's mindfulness. And it can be a little startling at times. You know, it's like, oh, mindfulness is back. And the mind gets so interested in that, that whatever it was attending to fell away. There can also be a little bit of focus at times. Sayadaw sometimes talks about, with thoughts in particular, that there's a kind of an energy that we can direct towards a thought. With mindfulness, he uses this analogy. It's kind of like shooting thoughts that, you know, like you direct the attention so closely to the thought that it just pops it. And it's almost more because the mind that is doing the directing is, again, it's kind of like that mind is taking up the energy that was going into the thought. So it's again not really about wisdom. It's more about kind of a sharp focusing of the mind. So these are some other reasons why that state might disappear when you become aware of it. If you see that in general you're not able to be aware of mind states, That it's just like there's not a sense of understanding what it means to be aware of mind states, then there may be some exploration to do around, I would say relaxation might help. Relaxing the awareness, relaxing the mind with the awareness. There may be a little bit of kind of like jumping on the object or something. A little bit of, as opposed to kind of that, I talk sometimes about allowing the mindfulness to infuse experience. So there's a way in which we can be aware of any state, but sometimes we have the habit of kind of not being aware in states, in particular states, and not a familiarity of what it means to be aware in particular states. And so for me, actually, you know, there was a little bit of work with this, and I would say that practice with Sayadaw really helped me to understand what it meant to attend to mind states. I understood what it meant to notice a specific, like, strong emotion like anger, you know, kind of like anger became an object and I could look at anger and see anger and feel how it affected the body. But to be with a state of mind that was more nebulous or vague, that took some time. And it's more the, you know, anger felt like it had a little bit more kind of a shape to it or something. And some of the mind states that I was learning to meet, well, anxiety is kind of like this. Anxiety has that quality of not, of often not having so much of a shape. It feels like it's nebulous. It feels very vast. Often anxiety has that kind of quality. And so the kind of mindfulness that can meet that kind of object is more open. Hard to describe, but and so sometimes you could also explore a kind of relax rather than just maybe check and see if when the mindfulness arises, there's a little bit of focusing there. And if there is, can that focusing relax and just be rather than aiming? Many of us have a kind of an aiming habit that we've learned with mindfulness. And that's connected with the aiming of the attention, and the mindfulness itself doesn't need us to do that. And also that aiming of the attention also often connects with objects that we know what they are. So we aim the attention at things we already know. We aim the attention at things we're already familiar with. And I think this came up this morning too. It's like the recognizing or the kind of the idea of mindfulness taking in something that we already know. We may not see things new experiences, new ways of meeting experience. Yeah, it did come up around the awareness this morning. So to kind of, it's like kind of stepping back and not having an agenda around the kind of objects. And so this, you know, some of this is just, again, our habit, our filter of what objects even are, what experience is, and what it means to be mindful of experience. This whole practice has shaken up those views and beliefs in my mind completely. So the kind of stepping back and relax the mind with awareness and see what is able to be noticed, as opposed to trying to look at the anxiety. Look at whatever it is that you're seeing disappear when you turn to when you notice it, rather than trying to look at it. You know, sometimes to me feels like some of these mind states are like really shy creatures in the forest. And as soon as you look at them, they freeze. And then they like want to disappear. And so, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, don't look directly at it. You know, just let it kind of come in the sides, you know, not looking right at something. Sometimes there's more that we can see about it. Another analogy that sometimes is useful with that is like looking at the stars. You know, if there's a patch of like the Pleiades up in the sky, you know, if I try to look right at the Pleiades, I don't see it very clearly. But and another one, here's maybe a better one, the double star in the handle of the Big Dipper. You know, if you try looking right at it, you might not see it because the rods and cones in the eye at that place are not so attuned to dim light. But if you look just off to the side, you can see it, because that part of the eye can take in that. So it's kind of like using that peripheral vision. Sometimes we can see things rather than looking right at them. So these are analogies that might support a sense of not trying to look right at something in order to see it. So there's another part to the question, but I think I'll open it up to questions in the room, see if there's any comments or questions in the room. So let's break the recording.